You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening. I'm Mimi Corcoran, President and CEO of Andrus and the former director of Open Society's Special Fund for Poverty Alleviation. The fund is now closed, but one of our key projects was supporting Sasha Abramsky's groundbreaking multimedia project on poverty in America, thevoicesofpoverty.org. You should all take a look at that website. It's really quite something. But we were so pleased that those efforts also led the way to his new book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives, which he'll talk about tonight. For those of you who are already familiar with Mr. Abramsky's background, he is a freelance journalist, and his work has appeared on The Nation, The Atlantic Monthly, New York Magazine, Salon, Slate, The Village Voice, and Rolling Stone. He is also the author of multiple books, including Inside Obama's Brain and Breadline USA. He is a former Open Society Media Fellow. You never get very far from Open Society. And is currently a senior fellow at the New York City-based Demos Think Tank. We also have the acclaimed Bob Herbert here, who will serve as the, and this is the word I keep stumbling over, interlocutor? Yes, and I kept saying, why don't we just say he's going to moderate his discussion? It would have been a lot simpler. Brought back a lot of memories from when I couldn't say I'd bring lilies to the marshes in a play in third grade. Mr. Herbert is a distinguished senior fellow at Demos, which he joined after an 18-year career at the New York Times as an op-ed columnist writing about politics, urban affairs, and social trends. Prior to that, he had an illustrious career in print and TV media, including as a national correspondent of NBC, and he was a regular contributor on the Today Show and NBC Nightly News. Mr. Herbert is the author of Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream, and is currently he's working on a new book, Wounded Colossus. I'd like to turn over the podium to Miles Rapaport, who's the president of Demos and a co-sponsor of tonight's event.
Thank you, Mimi. Well, we are, I'm Miles Rapaport, I'm the president of Demos, and we are delighted to be part of this event tonight. I want to acknowledge a few people before I start. First, I want to thank Open Society Foundations for hosting this, Mimi in particular for funding Sasha's work, which is a tremendous thing. Also, Maria Archuleta and Eric Blank, and of course, Chris Stone and Ken Zimmerman for making this space available and for supporting so much good work, including Demos's. I also want to acknowledge Rich Benjamin, who is at Demos, our coordinator for the Fellows Program, has worked closely with Sasha, and we are appreciative, very much so, of you making this event happen tonight, Rich. So Demos is a public policy organization dedicated to two fundamental propositions, an equal say in our democracy and an equal chance in our economy, and a third kind of theme, which is we want to change the narrative in the United States about social solidarity, racial equity, economic fairness, and all of those issues that have been for too long not down and out exactly, but not the mainstream of political thought. So we want to see policy changes, whether they are to open up voting rights or change the money in politics equation in the country. We want to work on issues of credit card debt and the economic challenges facing young people. And we specifically want to do work around the issues of economic inequality and its extreme version, which is the persistence of unabated and, in fact, increasing poverty in the United States. So in addition to doing the policy change, we really want to change the narrative around these issues so that the concerns that we share become the agenda for the country, and I think we can do that. So I'm very proud that both of the two speakers tonight are Demos senior fellows. Bob Herbert has been a Demos senior fellow since he left the New York Times and has been an absolutely brilliant writer and speaker on these critical issues for his whole career, and we're delighted that the last two have been at Demos. And you stole my thunder. I was going to tell everybody that Bob's new book, Wounded Colossus, which is coming out in 2014, will undoubtedly touch upon some of the same themes that we're talking about tonight. Sasha Abramski has been Demos Fellow for a number of years, has written a number of terrific books, Conned about the U.S. prison system, Breadlines USA about poverty and hunger in the United States, and of course the new book tonight, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Now I want to just do a teeny bit of history, and that is that Sasha's book pivots off of two books. One, which people are probably familiar with, is The Other America, written by Michael Harrington in 1962, just 50 years ago, which really helped to spark the war on poverty. The second book is actually an earlier book, which is written by Jacob Riis in 1890, called How the Other Half Lives. So it's no accident that the title of Sasha's book is The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. What's different now from when Michael Harrington wrote the book is Harrington wrote about seven pockets of poverty in the midst of plenty. His understanding of the reality of America was that there was a rising middle class, an economic system that was producing a broader middle class, economic affluence for many, many people, and that there were certain people who were left out. What's fundamentally different now, which Sasha will talk about tonight and talks about in the book, is that that's no longer the case. The pockets of poverty still persist, but they have been joined by a basic level of downward mobility and economic insecurity that people previously assumed to be in the middle class are now suffering. So the experience of poverty and economic insecurity are far more generalized today in a much deeper and more structural problem than we had even 50 years ago, which is not good news. But the good news is that people are raising their voices, people are making fights around this. There is an understanding now that this issue has got to be front and center. This issue and the issue of inequality have got to be front and center in our political debates. And the Sasha's book is a terrific kind of addition to that conversation. So let me pass it over to Bob Herbert, who's going to serve as interlocutor. Not that hard.
Oh, sure. Show off.
For tonight's debate. Bob, I take it to you.
I wanted to grow up and become a professional football player, and instead I became an interlocutor. I mean, who knew?
Say it three times fast.
No. I know better than that. First, thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. Really appreciate it. I want to thank the Open Society Foundation and Demos for hosting this event. I also would like to say thanks to Rich Benjamin, who looks out for us fellows. That's a little self-serving on my part, but so be it. Rich, thank you very much. What we're going to do is Sasha and I will have a conversation for a bit, then we'll open the floor to questions, and then after that, you guys are just going to buy tons of books. So we like that part especially.
Yes, we do.
Sasha, congratulations, and I guess we can just get to it. You mentioned just before we came on that we were talking about, not surprisingly, poverty, but you said it's amazing that we're even talking about it. I mean, it's an issue that has tended to be off the table when we're talking about public issues and public policies in the United States for the longest time. It's getting back out on the table now, and Sasha is giving it a much bigger nudge with this book, so we appreciate it. So to start, give us a picture of poverty in the United States. How big of a problem is this? How many poor people are they? And who are these folks?
I will do that in 1 minute, Bob. Before I do, I do want to thank a whole bunch of people for putting this on, for facilitating all of the work over many, many years for this project. I'm not going to go through a list of names, but everybody at the Open Society, everybody at Demos, everybody at The Nation Books, a huge thank you for your support for this work. Most importantly, though, I want to thank the hundreds and hundreds of people around the country who shared their stories with me. And that segues onto your question, Bob. What is poverty today? What does it look like? I found it absolutely fascinating. I had these assumptions, I think we all have assumptions, about what poverty is. We all tend to oversimplify it. We've been told for years and years and years that poverty is basically a set of stereotypes. We don't think of it as a set of individuals. We think of it as a set of failings. Our culture talks about poverty. It talks about the undeserving poor. It talks about drug addiction. It talks about mental illness. We have a whole series of cultural images of what poverty is in this country. And usually the people who perpetuate those stereotypes, people actually don't spend much time talking to people about what poverty really is and what it means to their lives. Now, this project took many, many years. And I went to food pantries, I went to churches, I went to community centers. I had a whole bunch of people in many, many states around the country who thought it was important to get these stories out and to have these voices and these faces made real. I went to rural Hawaii. I went to urban Philadelphia. I went to the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. I went to suburban Stockton in California. I went to communities in Las Vegas, where every house on the surface looks like a McMansion, 3,000 square feet, maybe a swimming pool. And every single house on that block is in foreclosure. And every single resident is in bankruptcy. I went to Detroit. I don't know how many people there have been to Detroit. It's quite extraordinary. Used to be one of the biggest, most important cities in America. It's got tens of thousands of vacant lots. It's got 2,000 to 3,000 urban farms within stone's throw of the downtown skyscrapers, where land is being reclaimed by people who are so poor that they're doing subsistence farming. So when you ask the question what poverty is, to me, it's as complicated as modern day America. You can't reduce it to those seven hotspots that Miles was talking about, that Michael Harrington identified a half century ago. He talked about Appalachia. He talked about the Mississippi Delta. He talked about certain Native American reservations. And he said, here's where poverty is concentrated. Well, if you go around America today, yes, there are still hotspots. You go deep into the Mississippi Delta, there's still extraordinary levels of poverty. You go into some of the reservations or some of the colonias in the Southwest, and again, you see levels of poverty that are almost unfathomable. But the poverty is also in New York. There was a lot of talk this week in the mayoral race about the scale of poverty. Almost half of New York residents are struggling to pay their bills. You go to suburban Los Angeles, you can find people who had jobs. They lost their jobs. Now they have jobs again, but those jobs pay a half to a third of what they used to pay, and they don't come with benefits. So I think when you talk about poverty in this country, what you're talking about is modern-day America. We think of ourselves as socially mobile. It's fundamental to our sense of self-image as a country. We're an upwardly mobile, we're an aspirational, we're an opportunity-based country. Unfortunately, if you look at the data, America today is less socially mobile than almost every other first-world country. What that means is, if you are born into poverty in America, you're far more likely to stay in poverty than if you were born into poverty in, let's say, Sweden, or Germany, or Canada, or even Greece, or Portugal, or any of the other bankrupt peripheral states in the European Union. If you fall into poverty, you lose a house, you lose a job, you have a healthcare emergency, that poverty is far more likely to cripple your future than it is in other first world countries. So I think today, poverty is a central part of the American narrative, and it's almost entirely ignored by the political classes. It's just this invisible crisis. And to me, that was the motivation for the book, is making something visible that should never have been allowed to become invisible.
I think a lot of Americans have a misunderstanding of the scale of this problem, just how many people really are poor in the United States. Can you give us a bit of a sense of that?
Yeah, I think that one of the reasons that it's so easy for people to ignore it is poverty does tend to, in a sense, make itself invisible. A lot of people I talked to said, well, one of the collateral consequences of losing income is you lose the ability to participate publicly. You can't afford to go to cafes, you can't afford to socialize in public, because socializing in America tends to cost a little bit of money. And when you're literally counting pennies, when you're literally juggling, do I buy food or do I buy school supplies? Do I fill a prescription? Do I pay rent? Do I let my telephone bill go or my gas bill go? At that point, you can't afford anything luxury. And you tend to make yourself invisible. You tend to pull back. You stay in your house. If you have a job, you go to your work, you come back. You can't afford to go out for lunch with your colleagues, so you're sitting in your cubicle instead. So it becomes this progressive process of marginalization. One of the results is, if you do not live in poverty, it's still fairly easy to pretend that you don't see the poverty. It's out there, but if you don't choose to look, to a degree you can still ignore it. But in actual fact, when you look at the numbers, we're not talking about 1 million, 2 million, 3 million. We're not even talking about 10 million or 20 million. 1 in 6 Americans, 15% of Americans, live in poverty by the government's own measure of poverty. And I say by the government's own measure because it's actually a fairly inadequate measure. But by that inadequate measure, 1 in 6 Americans are poor. Now, most of our social safety net has been shredded. Welfare is a pale imitation of what it was 40, 50 years ago. Access to a lot of benefits programs has been massively reduced. The one area where it's still relatively intact is food stamps at the moment, unless the Republicans get their way, in which case it won't be intact. But at the moment, food stamps is still pretty much intact. And so the numbers on food stamps serve as a fairly good proxy for the numbers in poverty, because if you're poor, with very few exceptions, the primary exception being if you're an undocumented migrant. But other than that, if you're poor in America, you qualify for food stamps. There are 47 million Americans on food stamps. That's a staggering number. 47 million Americans, by the government's own measure, are now so poor, are struggling so much, that if they didn't have food assistance, they would be malnourished. That's extraordinary. And the idea that we cannot talk about this is even more extraordinary. The idea that we went through an entire presidential election campaign last year and neither candidate made a major speech on poverty. Actually, one candidate did. He talked about 47% of the population. But with that exception, neither candidate addressed the problem. Now, Obama started to. He made a very interesting speech at the 50th anniversary commemoration of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and he did talk about poverty. And he talked about the fact that if you were going to deal with the issue of social justice, you had to tackle poverty in America. So Obama is actually now talking about it. But the question is there a political momentum behind that? Will it result in a programmatic change? Will it result in the energies of the state being focused on this issue? Probably not, unless people like you and me and everybody else who cares about this issue pushes it. Because the default is, if you don't push it, it's easier not to talk about it. It's easier to pretend that it doesn't exist.
From my perspective, one of the most shameful aspects of this issue is that for a while, the United States, if I understand it correctly, led the developed world in child poverty. I think it's now number 2, surpassed only by, believe it or not, Romania. I think it's 1 out of every 4 American children is poor, and 1 out of 3 African-American children. Talk a little bit about child poverty and the impact of poverty on the lives of children in this country.
Yeah, you're right on all of the data you gave, that we're in the sorry category of having more child poverty than every other country apart from Romania. And presumably at some point when Romania gets firmly beyond its Ceausescu legacy, they'll end up with less poverty than us, because almost every other country in the world puts more effort into tackling child poverty. It's seen as a basic measure of social stability and of social equity. And in America, we've let this problem fester. In the 1960s, we put some effort into tackling child poverty. We actually put more effort into tackling the poverty of the elderly. And the war on poverty's single greatest success was limiting elderly poverty. But we generally ignored child poverty. Now, if you go back 10 years to the beginning of the century, child poverty stood at 16%. And that was seen as staggeringly high. 10 years later, it's 22.5%. So just under 1 in 4 kids of all ethnicities, all races, is poor. That's an average. But you're absolutely right that African-American children and Latino children have far higher poverty rates. And I think you said 33%. If you go into some cities, 60-something percent. New Orleans. 66% of African American kids under the age of 5 lives in poverty. In Detroit, it's over half. Parts of Philadelphia, like North Philadelphia, again, 60-70% of kids live in poverty. Now, what does that mean? It's not an abstract concept. It means very, very tangible things. It means, not least of all, those kids are going to bed hungry, and those kids are waking up hungry, and those kids are going to school trying to get an education hungry. Now, some of that is alleviated. We have a school lunch, school breakfast program that's fairly functional. It puts a lot of people who would otherwise be hungry into some kind of food security. Here's a problem. It doesn't exist in the summers. Now, there's been a lot in the academic literature about the education gap that develops over the summer when kids regress educationally because they're not in class. The other thing that happens in the summer is that poor kids get hungry. A lot of localities have recognized that, and they've created these institutions that has a horrible sounding name. It's actually a fairly good institution, summer feeding programs. And summer feeding programs are places where low-income kids can go to get meals. Parks, community centers. Sometimes they're privately funded. Sometimes the federal government steps in with money. A couple years ago, the federal government stepped in to St. Louis with a pilot program to feed 10,000 low-income kids, kids who would otherwise go hungry in the summer. Here was Rush Limbaugh's response on the radio. He went after this program because it, quote, created wanton little waifs and serfs. People who would never have a work ethic because when they were young, they got free food. It's extraordinary. If he was a kid in a school and he behaved like that, we'd call him a schoolyard bully. He's not a kid in the school, he's a guy with a massive platform, and he's using his platform to beat up on hungry children. Now, if he was isolated, you'd say, oh, he's just a freak of nature, let's ignore him. But in actual fact, a large part of the political process is based on that idea. A large part of our current political rhetoric is based on the idea that if you use that kind of government service, even if you're a kid, you're somehow morally polluted, you're corrupted, you're soiled goods. And I think that's a scandal. And so, you know, for me, when I think of child poverty, I think of the kids that I met in East Los Angeles. They were teenagers, mainly children of immigrants, and they were in an honors program and they were being tracked for college. First of their families to go to college. And I spoke to this class, and one after another they told me, in the wake of the 2008 collapse, their parents had lost their jobs. These were immigrants doing janitorial work, domestic work. They'd lost their jobs, and one after another they told me they had either gone into foreclosure or if they were renting, they'd been kicked out. And this was the choice these kids were facing. Do I pursue my college dreams, and that means that for many years I can't financially help my parents, or do I give up my college dreams, drop out of school, get an $8 an hour job in a fast food restaurant, and put that money into supporting my parents? And that was the choice these kids were having to make. Now to me, that's the story of child poverty. It's not about wanton little waifs and serfs. It's about kids caught in an absolutely unpalatable situation. And those are the kinds of choices no child should have to make.
So how do we get in this fix? This didn't just happen with the Great Recession. This problem was building in the years before that. So what happened? This is an extraordinarily wealthy country. The mayor of this city is personally worth $27 billion. I can't get over that. I mean, he's been mayor for 12 years, but I'm still wrestling with it. But there are all kinds of wealthy people in this country. It's a rich country. So how did we get in this fix when there are so many people struggling? And we haven't even talked about the people who are just a notch or two above the official poverty level. What happened?
Well, one of the most interesting interviews I did with a policy expert when I was writing this book was with a Harvard Kennedy School of Government lecturer called Marshall Gantz. And Gantz has spent years as a community organizer. He's built these ideas of narrative storytelling. He's a very interesting guy. And he said, look, if you understand the problem as being poverty, you're missing the point. Poverty is a symptom. And the analogy he used, he said, poverty is the miner's canary. Now, in the olden days, before there were high-tech gas monitoring equipment, if you were a miner, you'd go down with your team and you'd take a canary, a little bird, with you. And if that bird suddenly stopped chirping and dropped dead, you'd know there was gas in the mine and you'd run. It was a warning sign something was wrong. And Gant said to me, this is what poverty is in modern America. It's a symptom of a much more fundamental malaise. And then he started talking about inequality. And he started talking about the fact that increasingly, we're two societies. A tiny sliver of people with huge access to resources, huge ability to manipulate the political process, and then everybody else. And Gant said, societies that develop the kind of inequality that America has developed over the last few decades are committing collective suicide. Historically, you cannot build a democracy around inequality this profound. Because once you have inequality of this level, once you have a few people monopolizing vast amounts of resources, the democracy itself ceases to be accountable. If you have access to money, you have access to power. If you have no access to money, you have no access to the political process, no access to power. And so I think the story of modern-day America, poverty is a symptom, but the real story is that over the last 40 years, we've developed a level of inequality no other democracy has. The way our country looks economically would be familiar to our great-great-grandparents who lived in the Gilded Age, which was also the age of Jacob Riis taking photographs of tenement slums. But it wouldn't be familiar to the people who grew up in the Great Society. It wouldn't be familiar to the people who grew up in the New Deal. And to a large extent, it wouldn't even be familiar to the people who grew up at the beginning of the 20th century in the Progressive Era. We're allowing a degree of inequality to develop in the name of deregulation that is going to have absolutely extraordinary long-term implications for the way our politics, not our economics, but the way our politics functions. So a large part of my motivation for the book was to explore the politics behind inequality. And a large part of the motivation for part two of the book, which is about solutions, is about changing the political discourse to make it unacceptable to allow this level of inequality to keep festering.
So there are two groups that I think about that even when people are talking about the poor, they don't talk a lot about. The first are the group right really at the bottom, the folks living, I think it's called deep poverty, the folks in deep poverty. And then there are the folks that I mentioned, a notch or two above the poverty line, the near poor. Can you talk a little bit about those two groups?
Yeah, no, that it's a really important question because poverty in America is sometimes hard to identify. I've traveled all over the world, and there are places where the poverty is so absolute that there's no mistaking it. If you travel to the slums of Bombay, for example, you see a level of poverty that's absolutely unmistakable because it's absolute. You're tripping over people who literally have nothing. The poverty in America is sometimes more subtle. Most people in poverty have something. Their poverty is relative rather than absolute. But there is this group of people that you talked about just now who live in what's called deep poverty. That's a government term, it's a statistical term, and it means they live at most half of the poverty level. So if the poverty level is $11,000 for a single person in a year, if you're in deep poverty, it means you're earning below about $5,500 or $6,000 a year. Turns out 6 million Americans live with literally no access to cash. They don't have jobs, they don't have savings, they don't have bank accounts, they either don't qualify for welfare programs like TANF, or they did qualify, but they time-limited out. 6 million Americans, including millions of kids, have no access to cash. So they survive on food stamps, which is a non-cash benefit. They survive on charity. They survive maybe occasionally doing black market economics. But they have no legitimate access to cash. And their lives are literally hand-to-mouth. An example would be a woman I met in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She was an undocumented migrant, and she was working as a domestic home help. And I talked to her about what she had. She started crying after a while because what she had was nothing. She had a couple dollars. She had hand-me-down clothes that her employer had given her. She was theoretically paid $7 an hour, but she worked 24 hours a day, which isn't legal, obviously, but she was basically on call 24/7. So if you actually worked out what she was really earning, it was probably about $2 an hour. And she had not a thing to her name. I met some migrant farm workers in El Paso, Texas, who lived in this community center called Sin Frontera. and it was literally on the border. You have the Rio Grande, you have the border crossings, you have 9th Avenue, and then you have this community center. And hundreds of migrant farm workers sleep there because they have nowhere else to live. And they sleep on the floor back to back. And at midnight they get up, and at 1 a.m. they go out onto the street, and they hang their possessions in plastic bags on the trees on the street, and they get bid out to the labor contractors, and at 2 a.m. they get put in the backs of trucks, and they're sent out to farms in Texas and New Mexico, and they do a day's labor, and they come back with $20 or $30. And I met this guy who had pawned the one thing he had, because it was the off season, he wasn't working. The one thing he owned in life was a portable black and white television. And he'd had to pawn it because he had no money. That's absolute poverty. But then there's this other group of people who are one notch up from that. And they might work for a company like Walmart. And Walmart markets itself as paying above minimum wage. It's quite a nice marketing. McDonald's does the same thing. We pay $1 or $2 above minimum wage. All well and good, except they spend a huge amount of money lobbying to keep the minimum wage low. Minimum wage has been stuck at $7 for years. Before that, it was stuck at $5 for years. 2 years ago, Obama made a commitment to raise the minimum wage to $9. Can't do it, because Congress has no interest in raising the minimum wage. So you've got workers like Mary Vasquez, who was an old woman I met, 67 years old, diabetes sufferer, cancer sufferer, heart attack victim. She came into the interview on a walker. She hobbled in, too poor to retire, works full-time at Walmart outside Dallas, non-unionized, earns before taxes about $1,800 a month. Does have health insurance through Walmart, but they take deductions. Is encouraged, in quotes, by the company to spend $300 a month buying Walmart stock. It was useless for her. She's never going to be able to retire anyway, but it's very good for Walmart if a million and change employers are buying their stock. So I said to her, well, you know, what do you eat? And she said, well, I'm supposed to eat healthy food because I have diabetes, but I usually eat 88 cents TV dinners from Walmart. And even then, I can't often afford it, so I go to bed hungry. And she was too sick to take the bus to work, and she didn't know how to drive, so she had to pay her neighbor gas money to drive her to work at Walmart. And to me, that's the near poverty. These are people who, according to Walmart, are doing okay because they're a couple dollars an hour above minimum wage, but no way you shake it are they actually doing okay. They don't have any economic security. And there's millions and millions of workers all over this country, but especially in the South, because a lot of the poverty is concentrated in places like Texas. All over the country, there are workers in that kind of situation. One of the things I thought was most stunningly disingenuous about the last election campaign, when Rick Perry was still running for the presidency, before he forgot his third point, one of the things he touted was the idea that even in the midst of the recession, Texas had created jobs. It's actually true. You look at the numbers, Texas is doing quite well. It's got far lower than average unemployment. It did create jobs during the recession. But he forgot to mention one other number, which is that even though Texas had 7% unemployment, while California had 12% unemployment, this was 2 years ago, Texas has one of the highest poverty rates in the country. So how do you square that? The only way you can square it is if an awful lot of people who are working full-time jobs in Texas are in poverty. Turns out when you analyze it, that's what's happened. Texas has such a deregulated workplace, it's basically functioning as a domestic maquiladora. Come to Texas, pay your workers appalling wages, create the most awful workplace conditions, and do it with the blessing of the Texas legislature. It's a hell of a way to market your state, but that's how Rick Perry did it. So I think that's what near poverty means to me.
So now I'm going to try and channel Rush Limbaugh's listeners. This is scary.
This is where we go into Gothic horror mode.
If I get trapped in here, somebody help me out. Why should we care about these folks? I mean, life is tough for an awful lot of people in this country. You know, why not just let the poor people fend for themselves?
Because those poor people are our neighbors, they're our relatives, they're our friends, and they could conceivably be us. Because we live in a world of economic insecurity. There's a Yale political scientist called Jacob Hacker. He wrote a great book, and he called it The Great Risk Shift. And he analyzed how in the last 4 decades, a huge amount of risk that used to be borne by corporations has shifted onto individuals. If you go back to 1980, most workers had defined benefit pensions. It meant at the back end of a 35 or 40 year career, they knew they were going to retire with a degree of security. Fast forward to today, almost no worker has a defined benefit pension. Same thing happened with healthcare. Tremendous number of workers lost their health insurance. Every measure, if you look at what's happened over the last 30, 40 years, if you're an ordinary American, not a particularly poor American, if you're in the middle, you are bearing more risk than you used to bear. And if you're at the top, you're bearing less risk than you used to bear. Your taxes have gone down. If you're a corporation, your benefits obligations have gone down. By every measure, there's a transference of risk downward. So when Rush Limbaugh appeals to his audience and says, you don't want to care about those people, first of all, it's stupid. But second of all, it's bait and switch. What he's basically saying is, don't pay attention to the real problem. Because the real problem is complicated, and the real problem involves actually thinking and pausing and analyzing. Just do the easy thing. And the easy thing has always been to look for somebody worse off than you, and to basically say, I'm not like them, I'm better than them, I don't really care about them. So why should we care? We should care because we are a society. There is such a thing as a social compact, but we should also care because realistically, we all have a stake in this. There's a self-interest to caring about this. And ultimately, there's a self-interest to working out policy solutions and working out a way of discussing this that takes us beyond that kind of soundbite. Because if we don't do that, if we don't rethink the way that we approach inequality, if we don't rethink the way we approach what kind of wages we pay workers, what it's acceptable for large corporations to pay workers, at the end of the day, that cycle of inequality just continues. And coming back to what I was saying earlier, if we define ourselves as a democracy, we can't let this kind of inequality last. You can go all the way back to Pericles. You can go back to political philosophers 2,500 years ago, and they were already writing and talking about the dangers that inequality pose to a stable political structure. There's nothing new about this. This is a problem that has existed for thousands of years. What's new at the moment is the American political process's inability to grapple with it.
Now, poverty is often seen as a problem primarily of non-whites, especially African Americans, but also Latinos. I guess a couple of questions. One is, to what extent is this true or not true? And two, to what extent has this prevented us from really engaging or grappling with the problems associated with poverty?
It's a great question, because there's just no doubt about it that we do think of poverty as being something other people experience. And I use that with quotes around the word other, but while it is true that a disproportionate number of African Americans and Latinos live in poverty, it is also true that in absolute numbers, more whites are in poverty. So if your measure of why I should care is, does it affect my group? And to me, that's a crazy measure, but a lot of people do measure it that way. If that's your measure, by any way that you calculate it, this is an issue that affects every ethnicity, every race. It affects every geographic region in this country. So if you're going to craft policy responses, you have to craft policy responses that are going to get into all those different communities, all those different regions. So you're going to find concentrated pockets of poverty in African-American communities, in Latino communities, but you most certainly are also in white and Asian communities and every other ethnicity. And it only takes a little bit of energy, a little bit of effort. If you're a journalist, if you're a policymaker, if you're a commentator, it only takes a little bit of effort. All you have to do is get in your car, drive somewhere, and talk to people. And you'll find the scale of the poverty. And so I think the implication of looking at it as something that only affects other people or other groups, in a sense, it shrivels the imagination. What it means is we're not thinking, A, about the scale of the problem, But B, as a community, we're not thinking about ways we can get together to solve those problems. So I think one of the things that we need to do as a society is to have a more honest conversation about who's in poverty, what that poverty means, and what can be done about that poverty.
Now, you talk a lot in your book about ways that we might begin to get out of this fix, these myriad problems that are associated with poverty. So give us a sense of some of the major, most promising proposals that you're suggesting.
Well, for me, this has always been a political question more than an economic question. A lot of conservatives say, well, we can't afford to fund our social safety net. We've overspent and we're bankrupt. That's the narrative at the moment. It's the Tea Party narrative. It's increasingly the mainstream Republican narrative. We've got to cut. We've got to slash and burn everything because otherwise our country is going to sink. And a lot of people talk about Greece. They keep saying, oh, we're going to become like Greece, or, oh, we've already become like Greece. And to me, there's a sort of medical analogy we could use here. Greece is a small country with very, very profound economic problems, genuine economic problems. It's run out of money, not being the least of them. When Greece spends money at the moment, it's basically spending loans from the European Union. It's completely out of cash. The medical analogy would be it's got a disease like cancer. It's got a disease that's eating it away. The American body politic doesn't have cancer. It's got anorexia. We are choosing not to nourish our public infrastructure. We've got a political narrative in play that basically says it is wrong to fund things like healthcare properly. It's wrong to fund things like public works programs properly. We could do it. We're a $17 trillion economy. We're by far the largest economy in the world. We have by far the most billionaires in the world. We have a tremendous amount of money that could be used if we chose to use it. If we chose to raise taxes on certain groups, if we chose to raise taxes on certain corporations, if we chose to readjust maybe 2 to 3% of our gross national product, a few hundred billion out of that 17 trillion, we have all of the wherewithal economically to create a viable new war on poverty. So how do you do that? Because if this is a political problem, you've got to change the politics. We've had 40 years of people saying government doesn't work, it can only deliver lemons. Well, if government can only deliver lemons, why throw good money after bad by giving it more money to develop bad programs? So it seems to me that the way you break out of this destructive cycle is the first thing you do is you push a few programs that are going to be universally popular, that you could implement and that could work, and that in working would shift the discussion about the role of government, in the same way as Social Security did in the 1930s. So I actually start, I have a whole bunch of solutions, but I start with two quite big ones. And they're, I'm sorry about this, but I'm going to increase your taxes. And I hope you'll bear with me while I explain why.
Build the bar, yeah.
Yep, no apologies, but you guys are going to pay a little bit more if my plan ever gets implemented. I'm going to advocate for something called an educational opportunity fund. It doesn't exist at the moment, but it should exist. And it's going to be a line on your income tax. It's going to start off as being 0.25% per year, paid by employees and paid by employers. The average wage in this country, median wage, is give or take roughly $30,000 a year. So 0.25% is $75 a year. It's not a huge amount of money. And here's what that money is going to do. It's going to create a pool of cash that's large enough that the government could access it to give at birth every single child born in America $5,000 to be put into an education fund and used for higher education 18 years from now. Over 18 years, that $5,000, by almost any realistic measure, is going to grow quite considerably. Maybe let's say it's $20,000. It's not going to fully fund someone's higher education, but it's a whole bunch better than going into the kind of student debt that people have at the moment. What about the people who don't go to college? Why would they have an incentive to buy in? their pool of money, if they don't go to college, is kept until they retire. At the back end of their working career, it's added to their Social Security payments. Since people who don't go to college tend to earn less over a lifetime, they tend to have lower retirements. If you boost their retirement with the Educational Opportunity Fund, everybody's got a buy-in. So you start at 0.25%, you familiarize people with it, and you show it works. And over 10 years, you gradually increase that to 1%. If you have a 1% line item tax paid by employees and employers, you could give every American child at birth $20,000. That money would almost entirely fund the higher education at the back end. It's a social insurance model like Social Security, but for education. Second way I'm going to increase your taxes, I'm going to have another line item on your taxes, and it's going to be for a public works fund. Because a huge number of people who thought they were invulnerable to unemployment found that in 2008-09, their jobs weren't secure. And they lost their jobs or they lost their hours. We ended up with 14 million people unemployed and millions more jobless, not even looking for work anymore. And we spent tens of billions of dollars through the stimulus, the American Recovery Act, basically indirectly trying to prop up the labor market. And it maybe saved about 3 million jobs. I think that's the best estimate. Why don't we create a public works fund that creates a pool of hundreds of billions of dollars to be released in the event of an employment emergency? So that money is there. We've already funded it through a tax buy-in. In the same way as you buy house insurance, you buy fire insurance, you buy car insurance, we've already bought a universal public works insurance. So the money is there to prop up the labor market in the event of an employment crisis. Two relatively small additions to the tax code that would create a universal buy-in. I don't know if you could do it. The political climate of our taxes is so toxic, it would be a hard sell. But it's a realistic plan precisely because it's ambitious. If you get people to buy into the idea that 21st century government is capable occasionally of delivering a Cadillac instead of a lemon, I think you've changed the political debate. I think you've rendered less potent the arguments of people like Rush Limbaugh or the Koch brothers. And I think if you can do that, then you can have a much more holistic anti-poverty initiative.
Why have we not done more? We know where the Republicans are coming from. We know where Rush Limbaugh's listeners are coming from. But what about the Democrats, and what about Barack Obama? Here's a fellow who his supporters love to tell you was a community organizer. Why have people in the United States that you might otherwise think would care about this issue, why have they not done more?
I think it comes back to the previous answer, that taxes have become so toxic and distrust of government has become so pervasive. So we almost sort of resort to a knee-jerk response. Government, bad. Taxes, bad. But, you know, it seems to me it's more nuanced than that. Government can be good, it can be bad. Taxes can be good, they can be bad. It depends what they're used for and how they're used, and whether they're used well. It seems to me we've gone through a cycle, and it, you know, you can trace it to many different causes, but let's say Watergate's fairly decent starting point. There's a series of events, late 60s, early 70s, which utterly corrode public faith in the good of government. And it turns us not just into people who are healthily questioning, but it turns us into a nation of cynics. And I think you can sort of identify a series of key processes over the last 30, 40 years where confidence in government just wanes. Another more recent example would obviously be the government response or non-response to Hurricane Katrina. And visually, in the most visceral way possible, you see every level of government failing. You see the county, the parish government failing, you see the state government in Louisiana failing, and you see the federal response being absolutely inept. And that was televised, it was put on YouTube, all over the world people saw that. And I think it further collapsed confidence in the ability of government to do good. And you see that now in opinion poll numbers. Almost nobody has confidence in the ability of Congress to do anything. Almost nobody likes the way Congress works. The president gets a little bit better ratings, but even there's tremendous public distrust, tremendous public anger, a lot of that anger justified, and a lot of that distrust justified. So I think the blame can be widely dispersed here, but in a sense the blame is not irrelevant, but it's secondary. We're in that situation, that's our reality. We're in a situation of pervasive distrust of government, and yet we need government. We need government to regulate, we need government to provide social insurance systems. We need those things to function. So the challenge is, how do you rebuild the confidence? How do you rebuild the structures of governance? How do you rebuild the way in which government and citizenry interact? I think it can be done, but I do think it's a tremendous lift that you really have to work, not just in creative thinking to reinvent institutions, but in rebuilding the language, rebuilding the way we discuss public infrastructure.
I don't disagree with that. But, you know, the cynicism that the way in which people view government, I think it might go all the way back beyond Watergate to Vietnam. And we've seen what's gone on since the turn of this century. I think we'll probably wrap it up by I'll ask a question that's frequently asked of me when I'm going around the country. What can ordinary people do? People are going to read your book. I think people are going to be inspired by it. You offer many potential solutions. And obviously it's a heavy political lift, but the question becomes, how do you turn that heavy lift into, you know, how do you make it real? So what can ordinary people do, and whose responsibility is it, if government has not been responsive to this point, to apply the pressure to try and get government to respond?
It's a terrific question, and I've always thought that change in America comes from the ground up, and it almost always has come when groups of people have organized, whether it's into trade unions, whether it's into civil rights organizations, whether it's into suffragette movements, if you go back 100 years or so. Usually the most inspiring changes have occurred when a critical mass of people in communities have gotten together and said, look, things have to change. And I think we're starting to see that. You see groups like the National People's Action, for example, organizing very creative approaches on the banking system, on the housing crisis. You see groups, I interviewed a farmer in Des Moines. She said, I've never, outside of Des Moines and Iowa, she said, I've never been political before. I've never done anything like this. But I can't stand the way that these corporations are taking it from us. And she, it was, you know, a somewhat inchoate response, but she was talking about the way the tax codes were structured. She was talking about the way the banks had been bailed out. She was angry. And she had joined various groups. And she was going to shareholder meetings. She was protesting some of the decisions that bankers were making. She was protesting some of the decisions that various other corporations had made. And I think that basically that is what's probably going to happen over the next 5, 10, 15 years, that some politicians will tackle it at a state level, at a federal level. There'll probably be some interesting initiatives. California the other day began debating legislation for a $10 minimum wage in California. I think really interesting things can occur politically, but I suspect they will occur in tandem with grassroots organizing. And I suspect when you said earlier that, you know, a lot of people came in with optimism about Obama because he was a community organizer, I suspect Obama himself realizes that if things are going to change, he and his colleagues in DC are going to have to be pushed to make those changes. Roosevelt certainly realized it in the 1930s. He's on record as telling people to push him on certain issues. Johnson certainly knew it in the 1960s. It seems to me that the creative dance between political leadership and citizenry is an age-old dance. And when both parties engage, citizenry and politicians, that's when things happen. And so I think there is room for change. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but I do think that over time, there is definitely room to shift the debate on this.
I think that was terrific. If we could give Sasha a round of applause. And then I really appreciate that. I thought those answers were so thoughtful and so detailed. It's like, you know, some meat. You can, like, get into it. I really like that. So let's have some questions out here.
Why do you think the American populace is so lacking in the quality of empathy.
Yeah. Can I twist the question a bit? I actually don't think the public is lacking in empathy. I think the way in which our politics works at the moment lacks empathy. I actually think when you talk to people individually, they can be quite empathetic on a lot of levels, and especially when you humanize stories. When people are presented with abstract concepts, the welfare class, the food stamp president, all these stereotypes, that's when the lack of empathy kicks in. When you actually sit down with somebody and you say, well, how about we talk about a concrete case? How about we talk about this person who lost their job and they're hungry? They might be very empathic. They might go to the food bank and donate a whole bunch of food. They might not have thought through the programmatic implications. They might not immediately go out and join an organization or protest an injustice. But on an individual basis, I do tend to think when I talk to people that there is a well of empathy, but it needs to be channeled. So I'm not sure I entirely agree with the way you're approaching that.
I disagree. I mean, I think people will answer with things like, well, you can't help everybody, so why should you help anyone?
I think it's true to a point, and you'll find some people who say that. I also think that the way our communications technology works at the moment, we amplify anger. So if you go onto a blog site, for example, and there's a whole bunch of angry comments about welfare scroungers and so on and so forth, it's very easy to think everybody in the country thinks that way. But actually, it's more than likely most people don't think that way, but the people who are angry enough and bitter enough are the ones who spend the time going online to log their comments. So I think we have to be careful to say everybody's unempathic. But I do, you know, obviously some people do say some very cruel things.
Thank you.
I think Bob Hurwitz before raised something very important, and that is racism is really at the core of a lot of this public perception. And I worked in the streets of Brownsville, East New York in the 60s. And I dealt with it was work. It was the slum of the slums, and I did that throughout the city. A lot of that's gone, but what stuck in a lot of the white people's folks in this country is that probably it was a black and Latin question. They never understood the depths of their alignment and self-interest as the same with the blacks or Hispanics, and I will point out exactly what I did. During the rise of the Tea Party, when Michelle Bachmann was out there and Ryan was out there, I did an analysis of how the congressional spending went into every single congressional district of every single Tea Party person. It was in the billions of dollars. Michelle's congressional district had millions of dollars and some put up to $1 billion of federal funds, student aid, food stamps, Pell Grants, Social Security benefits, but they didn't know it. They don't know how much federal money is to the neighbor next door, to the kid across the street, and that dialogue was completely missing from any discourse. I gave it to the New York Times and they did one story with it. This has appeared no place. The Tea Party people don't know how much money the federal government is giving their own people. If that dialogue becomes more well known, then government would not be viewed as the alien beast that it is, because the people who are controlling the Tea Party propaganda are the very rich people who like this conversation. Rush Limbaugh flies his own jets. He makes over $100 million a year.
Thank you.
I mean, you're absolutely right about where the money goes. And there was a very interesting study about a year ago, and it was on people who self-identified as conservatives. And routinely, they under-identified their own involvement with government. You're absolutely right. It turned out that they were getting government assistance, Social Security, mortgage tax relief in particular, but they didn't identify it as assistance. And you know, coming back to this idea of empathy, I do think that a lot of people are very quick to say, if you're on welfare, you're definitionally undeserving. And we're going to make it hell for you to get benefits. And one of the big discussions of the moment has been, you know, what can we do to make it even harder to access benefits? Can we fingerprint people? Can we make them take drug tests? can we do criminal background checks?
The fingerprint is the housing authority people.
Housing authorities do it in California until last year. To get food stamps, you had to do it. And as a result, only half of eligible people in California got food stamps. But imagine if we were to say the same thing for those self-proclaimed conservatives who are getting mortgage tax relief. Imagine if we said, next time you file a tax return, if you want to get your mortgage tax relief, you're going to have to pee into a cup to prove you're not smoking marijuana. It would be impossible. Imagine if we said to an elderly person, we're not going to give you Social Security until you go into an office and allow us to fingerprint you. It's not going to fly. So I think the lack of empathy is intensified when benefits are defined as only being used by others. It's actually not true. You're absolutely right. Almost everybody in this country is using some form of government benefit.
Just going back to this question of empathy, I agree with you that some people are actually quite empathic, but as you point out, what happens is what I call the 1,000 points of light model, which is that people channel their empathy into kind of individual, private sector, nonprofit, charitable, religious-based kinds of actions. And in order to do what you're talking about, and what some of us may believe is the really only way to solve this, which is, you know, a government effort, somebody or somebodies would have to make really the moral case for doing something. And I'm curious who, if anybody, you think out there now is making the moral argument, and who those people are. Is anyone doing it?
And you're talking about within the political process.
Well, within the public sphere.
I think lots of people are making the case, both inside the political process, inside academia, inside think tanks, foundations, and so on. In a sense, we come at this with a massive head start compared to Michael Harrington in 1962. Harrington in 62 basically is a lone voice. He is going around the country and he's seeing poverty. Nobody's listening to him. Nobody in politics is talking about it. Nobody in academia is devoting their work to systemic poverty problems. And he said, look, we're not, you know, we might be in a partial age battle, but it's an incomplete story. And Harrington was basically a lone voice pushing a political process, issuing a moral challenge, and basically saying, live up to our own ideals. And he was very successful. Within a few years, the war on poverty takes off, and suddenly there's a huge infrastructure in place to talk about this. The reason I say we have a head start is today that infrastructure is still in place. There are still economists who do nothing but study poverty. There are still think tanks doing that. There are foundations that give out grants. And there are a tremendous number of politicians. So we've had a lot of conversation tonight about politicians ignoring the issues. There are a lot of politicians who care about this, but their voices get drowned out. Someone like Elizabeth Warren in the Senate, for example, she clearly cares about the issue. Raoul Grijalva, the chair of the Progressive Caucus, he talks about poverty all the time. If you go to the state level, there are a whole bunch of state senators, a whole bunch of state representatives who are trying to create state-level anti-poverty initiatives. At a city level, cities are doing really creative stuff. Richmond, California, recently began a plan to essentially reclaim foreclosed houses from the banks and sell them back to owners at a reduced rate. There are cities, counties, states, and people in the federal government trying to do this. What isn't being done is connecting the dots. The holistic approach isn't there. The idea of understanding how interconnected all these issues are. And I think in part that's because at a cabinet level, this is a totally ignored issue. We have a Labour Secretary, but the Labour Secretary generally deals with things like workplace violations. We have an Environmental Secretary, the Department of the Environment, who could deal with major urban environmental issues, but generally not so much. There are all kinds of things that could be done at a federal level, at a cabinet level, and that aren't. You could connect the dots. You could say this is as important as, I don't know, Department of Education is as important as Department of Health and Human Services. It merits its own department. You could create a cabinet level position. We've had a drug policy czar for 40 years in this country. Why not have a poverty czar? Why not have somebody there coordinating and connecting the dots? I think that would do a huge amount.
I've heard the name Rush Limbaugh mentioned a few times tonight. Yet, the one station that we have in New York to discuss issues like these, which is WBAI on radio, the progressive community hasn't come to the rescue of the station, which it almost went under. Maybe we'll survive, maybe not. So let's look at the entire community here, both the 1% with all, you know, all the capital, and the rest of us, and who is going to stand up for progressive issues if we can't save the one channel on the radio where we can securely discuss issues like these and others. I mean, that to me is pretty tragic. The second thing is, you said things seem to be getting worse, and I watched under Obama, all the statistics, all the data, as you say, have been getting worse. So what would you say to people who say, the only thing left for us is class warfare? They're already accusing de Blasio of being a proponent of class warfare. What is left if we can't use our legislators, if we can't use Congress, if we can't use all those systems that are available to us? The unions now represent a fraction of the American populace. What is left to us except that?
The rhetoric around class warfare I've always found very strange in this country. The last election, there was a whole patter of comments from conservatives saying that Obama was ginning up class warfare. The rationale they used was that he was talking about increasing capital gains tax and therefore was a class warrior. It seems to me absolutely bizarre that you talk about marginally increasing the taxes of the wealthiest Americans, and that's class warfare, but you talk about eliminating cash assistance for hungry children, and that's not class warfare. So it seems to me that class is an undeniable part of our discourse. Because we're an unequal society, definitionally, not everyone's a member of the same class. We get squeamish when we talk about it. We like to pretend we're all middle class, but there's no way that Michael Bloomberg, with however, you said 27 billion? There's no way that he's middle class. And there's also no way that the farm worker I met who had a porn his television is middle class. And so it seems to me that our understanding of class in our public discourse is a little bit bizarre. Now, in terms of whether or not what you were saying was there's no choice for class warfare, I think there are many choices. And it seems to me that there are all kinds of ways that you can reinvigorate the political discourse. And there are all kinds of ways that as citizens we can get involved in that political discussion that don't involve going to the barricades. There are different ways that one can push a political agenda. There are different ways that one can discuss issues of poverty or issues of equity. And so I'm always reluctant to go down that road and say that we're about to have class warfare. I don't think we are in this country. But I do think that we have a very disingenuous way of talking about the issue.
Nobody asked me, but I think we've been engaged in a class war for the past 40 years, and we've been losing. So somebody should pay attention to that. So. Yes, sir.
Bob Larry. The UN Mental Health and Sustainability Conference. Thank you for your good work and the importance of these issues and a more ethical society in general, as well as juvenile rehabilitation. In terms of, you mentioned language and empathy, there's a group, by the way, up in Westchester, who's a good focus in terms of coalition of mutual respect, is having a Yitzhak Rabin function in October. Saying the issues of dignity and empathy. How do we talk to each other? How do we work together? It's a legend of a rabbi.
Can you speak a little bit closer to our call?
I'm sorry. It's a black reverend and a white rabbi. And how do we work together for a culture of mutual respect? I've been saying local to global, including New York State, and in New York City, you can model for those issues, including better education. And don't you think that this is a moment in time in terms of poverty, particular opportunity, that there's so much dissatisfaction, the issues of benign neglect, there's so much poverty in the whole world, with all the violence in the whole world. But today, it's not just, frankly, as one gentleman said, the racial racist issue of poor blacks and the excuses that are given by conservatives, but it's the middle class, as well as so much of the developed world, and the need for new economic models, the open society. Mr. Soros has an new investment institute that talks about the need for better economic thinking.
Thank
you.
Hi, my name is Nikhil Boyle. My question is, we've seen in the 2008 economic crisis that a lot of middle class families lost a lot of their savings. I'm curious, have you ever seen in your travels this move from big banks to more local and community settlements? Is there a movement among these impoverished communities to move and transfer their money to these more locally controlled entities?
A really interesting question. I know there are movements like that afoot. I personally didn't do interviews around them. What I did do interviews around was a community credit union in Boston. And they were dealing with very poor neighborhoods of Boston where a very large number of homeowners had gone underwater and lost their homes. And so you were seeing this reemergence of profound poverty in homeowning communities. And the banks were basically taking over these homes and sitting on them. And a few years back, Harvard Law School set up a legal clinic to deal with foreclosures. And they began working with a community organization that was on the ground trying to stop foreclosures. And then they began working with a community credit union that started raising money to buy back distressed properties from the banks and to resell them at renegotiated rates to the homeowners. And it was a tremendous success. Because everybody won. The banks were foreclosing homes that might have had $500,000 mortgage on them, and they were selling them for maybe $100,000 because nobody wanted the homes. So the banks were taking a huge hit. Homeowners were losing their homes. It was a lose-lose. So the credit union came in and said to the banks, we'll give you, let's say, $200,000. You're going to take a hit, but it's going to be far less of a hit than if you'd had to sell the house on the open market. And then we're going to sell it back to the homeowner at the new rate. So their mortgage goes down from $500,000 to $200,000. They sign a profit-sharing agreement with the community credit union. Everybody wins. So I have seen things like that. And I actually argue in my book that the federal government could do a very similar thing, that if it can be done by Boston Community Credit Union, there's no reason the federal government itself couldn't step in and build up a public housing stock again, a good public housing stock of affordable housing, by taking over distressed properties and having the ex-owners either rent the property or buy it back at a reduced rate. If they rented it, every month the percentage of what they were paying to the government could be used to rebuild a mortgage nest egg. And after a few years, if they were financially stable, they could buy the property back off the government at a reduced rate. Again, it's a win-win situation. So there are these creative things that can be done around banking and around housing and the interrelation, especially between the two. But I'm sidestepping your question because the answer is no, I didn't actually interview specifically.
Thank you for both in your presentation this evening. I'd like to engage a remark about empathy. And I think it goes much more deep than your knowledge. It's an ideological problem because it's part of the ethos of American discourse and psyche. There's something here called the myth of the heroic individual. The myth of heroic individualism goes back to the frontier days, which it was claimed that there were folk who did it all by themselves, forgetting about the Pony Express and Lewis and Clark owning it up to them. And that has endured, and endures today. And it leads those who subscribe to it to say, well, if you have to do it by yourself. I mean, I did, and you don't deserve any help. If you fail, you just fail. So Darwinian. But in that sense, I think it goes into the ethos. And so if you accept that, what kinds of solutions might you offer if you accept that it's deeper and it's ideological and it's part of the ethos?
It's a really interesting question, because historically there's been a very complicated relationship in America between the individual and the state. And in our understanding of poverty and how you deal with poverty as an individual, and you talked about the sort of myth of the frontier, you're absolutely right. It's in a sense hardwired into our sense of self as a country, that this is a country that rose from nothing over a vast expanse of land and created something. It's partly true and it's partly not true, but it's a sort of somewhat oversimplified narrative. I think if you look at it, when you really understand the history, throughout American history, the government's been involved to one degree or another in seeding the public infrastructure. You could go back to the 1820s and the building of canals. You could go into the 1860s and the role of the government, even though it was private companies, but the government was involved in the transcontinental railroad to a degree. Wherever you look, you could look at the subsidization of the giving of land to homesteaders. That's a government subsidy. I think, how do you get beyond the sort of myth of the self-made country and the self-made individual? I'm a fan of reading history. I think the more you understand history, the more you realize the complexity of the world you live in. And, you know, you can't order people to read history. You can't order politicians to think before they talk. But you can hope they do. And I think maybe that's it's not a particularly programmatic response, but I could think and hope that people think more carefully before they talk.
It is often this is taking a moment for us to take a seat. Also in the realm of religious discourse, since we have so many people on the right saying that they're such deep Christians, that ethos goes against the ethos of Christianity. And one might turn to them and say, well, you know, the Bible you claim which you're so lovely says, love your neighbor as yourself, and if you have not taken care of the least of these, you know, you're going to go off into hell. And that might be one way to approach it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to offer my thanks to Open Society Foundation's appreciation for DEMOS for yet again a very interesting forum tonight. It's good to be here. I wanted to ask about, I guess, this notion of relative poverty and utilitarianism in solving issues of poverty. I work for a foundation that's focused on poverty issues here in the U.S., but a lot of our cohorts spend a lot of time thinking about issues of poverty outside this country's borders, and we end up getting into some really strange conversations around need. And I think it might stem from some of the things we talked about here tonight. If you're working in an environment of scarcity, if we've got our government resources becoming more and more scarce, our private system only offering marginal resources to solve larger social problems through philanthropy, so we end up in a resource-constrained environment, which takes us perhaps to a utilitarian approach to solve some of the issues, which might say, if I have a dollar to solve a problem that goes farther in Bangladesh, I'm going to use it in Bangladesh rather than here in the United States. There might be a larger connection to how relative poverty or prosperity affects your sense of well-being and your willingness and ability to participate in civic discourse or other kinds of social functions, which I thought was a very interesting point you made about what it takes to be part of civil society, economically speaking. So I just offer those sort of questions and comments and see if you have any response.
I mean, I think this idea that, you know, if I have a dollar, would it be more effective to spend it somewhere else because the poverty is more absolute? Is that?
Yeah.
I think it's a false choice. First of all, if you're talking about the government itself, one of the great misperceptions amongst the American public about government spending is Americans routinely think we spend more on foreign aid than we do. Not just a little bit more, but usually when people are asked how much do we spend, they're wrong by a factor of 10. As a country, we actually give relatively little in overseas aid. And certainly if you brought all of that money back in and you invested it domestically, it probably wouldn't be enough to make a huge dent in the domestic poverty problem. If you're going to tackle poverty from a policy perspective domestically, you have to rethink about domestic taxes. There's no way around it. If you want to have money for an anti-poverty program, you can't live in a country where only a few thousand people a year pay estate taxes. You can't have a situation where corporations like General Electric have huge abilities to avoid their tax bill. You can't live in a country where oil companies are dramatically undertaxed. There have to be choices. If we want to fund domestic anti-poverty programs, we have to have a smart conversation about a more progressive tax system. Now, the other issue is, it seems to me that if you put an emphasis on poverty overseas, far from diminishing the attention that's paid on poverty domestically, it actually has the potential to accentuate it. Because if you're focusing moral energies on Bangladesh or India or wherever it might be, why not also focus moral energies domestically? I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I think it's actually healthy to say this is a global issue, that there are A, global inequalities that need to be discussed, but B, there's a level of unnecessary poverty, both globally and domestically, and that also needs to be discussed because it's an equity issue.
So we're going to have a book signing, so these last two questions, you can help us out if you keep it really tight.
Can we make it three questions? My
father-in-law
is standing very patiently at the
back for
a time. Where is he? He just left. There he is.
Thank you. These last three questions. So just some quick comments. First, I appreciate the ideas that you're bringing forth. It has been intrigued in the book. I went right into Amazon. You know, so you can't sign it because it's digital, and I prefer it that way. But the ideas that are coming up on the floor are pretty interesting also, because my family, in the last 24 months, we had like a lot of options. Every time we had to open a bank account because different things were coming together that had to be separated, we looked and we said, you know, we'd like to go to a small local bank, but there's such an insecurity. And another course I learned some time ago that anytime there's fear, that means there's a lack of information. If something sounds like a good idea, but there's some fear factors. So the demo was to bring it up again, and you brought up that situation in that city in California where they renegotiated the notes as a government, you know, in their jurisdiction. And we're talking about local banks again. There's just sometimes we just need the more information to be able to do that, because it's hard to patronize these huge banks. You know, I mean, I'm just ashamed to tell you who I got my mortgage with. You know, what just happened? You know, next buddy to Countrywide. You know, and it was uncomfortable, you know, but if you get these new ideas, and when I hear more, like, I know there's just a lack of information as to how, you know, secure you can be with the smaller banks and what have you, you know, so I just appreciate the conversation. I want to thank my mentor, my professional mentor, Mr. DeWernington, who invited me, because I see the way this goes. When he came up, he gave his name, and then I gave my name, which meant nothing, because I was plus one. When you have these things, I encourage you to bring somebody that wants to hear and learn and understand things. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
There's a line I heard from a CEO once. If you want to get rich, sell to the poor. And what it speaks to me is the levels and levels of predation that exist against the poor. Mortgages obviously cost more. Food costs more at the grocery store. Banking costs more. We've been talking in much of this discussion about public policy. But I know, Sasha, this is something you've reported on for many years. How do we address the elements of a society where the most vulnerable people and the poorest are victimized by the most predacious elements who can take their money?
That's a great question. I wish I had an easy answer, because you're absolutely right. You go into a poor community, you see overpriced junk food being sold, you see a tremendous amount of liquor stores, you see a tremendous amount of payday loan stores, which are the most predacious, dishonest form of loan in this country. So how do you get beyond that? Well, you can't just do it legislatively. There's a limit to what you can accomplish through laws and through political debate. Part of it, I think, is choice. You've got to, for example, create alternative food distribution networks. A lot of the most creative work on this issue is going on by nonprofit groups in states like California, which are putting in a tremendous amount of effort to get healthy and affordable foods into poorer neighborhoods, to get healthy and affordable farmers markets, for example, to get those farmers markets to accept food stamps. There are things that can be done to increase choices. You can't legislate payday loans out of existence. People have tried, you just can't do it. The courts aren't going to allow you to. But you can offer viable alternatives. People don't go to payday loans because they like paying 400 or 500% interest. They go to payday loans because they aren't given options. Well, what if you give options? What if you expand access to microcredit systems? What if you give federal subsidies so microcredit isn't just about starting up small businesses, but can be used to tide somebody over at the end of a pay cycle? There are ways that you can use institutions and use government money and use nonprofit money to create more choice in poor neighborhoods. It's not going to solve everything, but I do think that's a part of the problem, that you see the worst kind of exploitation when you see the least kind of genuine choice. Mm-hmm. A partial answer.
Thank you.
Thanks, Seth. Congratulations on the book. So my question was about, I mean, you've spoken about government and so somewhere this way is part of the solution. I mean, I work with a tenants attorney and work with the Legal Aid Society. All my clients live in Brownsville or East Flatbush. They're part, you know, some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. I find often, like, you know, just today as an example, like, it's my clients, what they complain most about is, in some ways, the government is the city. The very city, the, you know, the HRA, corporate assistance, the housing authority, whatever, the very many organizations, the very many agencies that have to rely on to get by. And, you know, many of the employees at these agencies themselves are people that are the neocore in the city. You know, they're union members, but in many cases, they are also on food stamps. So, to me, I mean, I find this idea that, you know, sometimes when I speak to my clients, they have their most sort of, they're most aggrieved at the city agencies. So, I wonder what the folks that you talk to, you know, what were their thoughts about government? You know, I mean, because certainly, as the last questioner sort of mentioned, sometimes it feels to me like the only people who are happy with the government services are the very slumlords, you know. Who benefit handsomely from the, you know, the rental years.
It's a great question, really, because you're absolutely right that poor people often have deeply unpleasant interactions with government agencies. And at least in part, that's because those government agencies have been set up to be deeply unpleasant. They've been set up to provide a disincentive to get engaged. So for not all institutions and not at all moments in time, but in the recent past, one of the purposes of welfare agencies, for example, has been to work out who's ineligible for welfare. One of the purposes of housing agencies has been to deter too many people from trying to get access to housing. If you give people mediocre services and you deliver them with a snarl instead of a smile, you're going to have a whole bunch of people who are legitimately very dissatisfied with their interaction with government. I think it's sort of worth internationalizing the question a bit. If you go to other countries that don't create such unpleasant bureaucracies, the level of dissatisfaction with government isn't there. You could go to a Scandinavian country with a much more comprehensive social safety net system, and the way that the poor in Scandinavia deal with and are dealt with by government is different. There's more of an interaction of respect. There isn't that sort of humiliation built in. When I was researching the book, I was driving around the country and doing these huge distances, and so I've listened to university lectures on CD, and I listened to this series on Roman life, Roman history, and I was listening, and there was this whole section on a category of Roman non-citizen called the humiliores. The humiliores didn't have any of the rights of Roman citizenry, and they were allowed to be treated particularly awfully by the state. Most notoriously, You could not crucify a Roman citizen, but you could, and they did, in copious numbers, crucify the humiliores. It was a way of showing a sort of case system. And I was thinking about this as I was interviewing America's poor. And it struck me that what we were seeing in modern day America was the creation of our own version of the humiliores. And the word humiliate obviously comes from that. We have a group of people, we think it's all right to humiliate. We have a group of people, we think it's okay to use the power of government to humiliate when it has to interact with government. And you see it in your clients' cases when they go to a housing authority and they try and get housing and they're dealt with as a criminal. You see it in a state where someone goes because they're hungry and they try and get food stamps and they're fingerprinted. It's an awful way to deal with poverty. You know, to me that's a sort of, probably a powerful way to wrap this up, is that a modern society should not create a caste of humiliores, but that's what we've done, and it leads to tremendous levels of anger and distrust.
Thank you so much, both of Sasha. And this audience, this was some kind of a terrific audience, so I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.